Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today I've got with me our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Hello. And also, sneaking in, it's our deputy editor, Matt Matum.
Hello.
Hello. This week we'll be talking with Dakota Johnson and Tracy Ellis Ross about The High Note, as well as appraising that, plus new Netflix show Space Force and Weepy, The Last Full Measure. Plus we'll be testing your movie space knowledge in our weekly quiz. But first, I think we should talk to Matt Matum about his experience on the super secret set of Tenet, which is the cover of our magazine, which is our new issue coming out this Friday. Matt, what can you tell us about it?
Well, it was obviously an immensely exciting visit and one of the highlights of my career slash life to get to go on a Christopher Nolan set, and not only just go on a set visit where sometimes, you know, you just see dialogue scenes or whatever, but this was a full-on ginormous Nolan scale set piece with a full-size real plane that had been crashed into the side of a hangar and it was getting blown up and all that. So it was a very, very exciting set to be on. And yeah, it was a lot of fun to kind of write it up and speak to everyone about it afterwards for this kind of monster feature in the new issue.
I mean, Nolan's hoping that he can open this film on the 17th of July. Is this the film that we really want to see? Is this the one that's going to make cinemas come back? Are we hopeful? What do we think, boys?
Well, yeah, it'd be a great one to start with, wouldn't it? Start it off with a bang, as it were. Nolan's films, I mean, they've got to be seen on the big screen. You just can't really watch them on your tablet or your phone, really, especially if we're looking at the scale that Matt's describing in his feature with real-life planes doing real-life explosions. So, yeah, fingers crossed.
That's definitely the most shocking detail from the feature, is just this, the idea of Nolan crashing a real plane into a real hangar. It just sounds insane.
Yeah, that they were just like, they went shopping for a 747. That's amazing. And also in the feature, you can see that the cast were pretty surprised at that as well, weren't they?
Yeah, even they were saying, yeah, just obviously you read it in the script, but then when it's actually a Nolan film, you get there and you're on the tarmac and there's actually a real plane and no kind of green screens or anything. And yeah, and it also, another thing that just surprised me about the whole thing was, again, often on set visits, it's very slow. You're doing one kind of small take at a time, and then there's a lot of waiting kind of between setups. But this, considering the scale and everything, it was just kind of really insane to me just how much they covered in this kind of relatively short time. I was there for like half a day. It was a night shoot, so half a night, let's say. But just the kind of different angles they got on it, and then they kind of finished that bit they were doing with the plane and did some stuff inside as well with the cast. And yeah, it was just, I've never kind of been on a set like that where they've just worked so efficiently and just got so much covered. And yeah, so it was, yeah, just immensely exciting.
That's all very exciting, and you can read about it in the 14 pages of exclusives, world exclusive, in the new issue. But what you didn't tell us was what time you got there, what time you got to bed, what you had to eat.
Yeah, this was obviously, again, this was as brain scrambling probably as I imagine watching the film will be, because obviously I flew from the UK to California, and so my time zones were just completely out of whack anyway. And then it was a night shoot, so I was kind of, by the time it was starting, it was like I was already been awake for what felt like 48 hours or something. And again, I think if it was anything else, I would have just kind of passed out, but I just felt so awake with the excitement. Afterwards, I probably slept for 48 hours after that before going home.
And didn't you miss a tasty lunch break?
That was the only thing I can say that was disappointing about it, that I'd kind of finished what I was seeing before they got the craft services out. So yeah, that's the one disappointment I take away from the whole experience. But I did get an In-N-Out burger afterwards, which was a pretty good treat. So yeah, it wasn't all bad.
How secretive were they with your phones and recording devices and stuff like that? Was it next level or was kind of as expected?
Compared to some I've been on, that wasn't too bad. I mean, I was actually the only person on this set as well. So, and I was with Emma Thomas, who's the producer, and Christopher Nolan's wife, kind of guiding me around most of the time. So I guess there was the presumption that I probably wouldn't just whip out my phone and start taking some personal snaps. But I've been on some before where they've kind of, like sort of Marvel set visits and things like that, where they sort of tape up the camera on the back of your phone and force you to sign these kind of weird NDAs where they take your photo to go with it and all that kind of thing. But no, it's sort of, again, that was a strange thing about the whole thing for the scale and everything. It just felt oddly relaxed, really.
Well, we cannot wait to see it. And if you want to read more about that, it's in the current issue, which is on sale, brand new, on Friday, the 29th of May. Thank you, Matt. You can go away now.
That's okay.
And have a lovely day, because we're going to discuss some other stuff. We're going to do a reader's question. If you could have a backstory of any existing movie character made into a film, what or who would it be? What do you reckon, Matthew and Jack?
I've got one. Well, I've got two, actually. And the first one is one that would nearly happened, and it's Jabba the Hutt. It's Guillermo del Toro's Jabba the Hutt. He had discussions with Lucasfilm at one point, and he was. They asked him what character would he most like to see as a standalone, and he voted for Jabba the Hutt, and I'm with him on that one. I think that would be terrific. I'd really like to see that. My other one would be Apollo Creed. For Creed 3, I'd like to see it do a sort of Godfather 2 style, flashing back to how he became world champion, and then corresponding that with how Donnie maintains his position as the top boxer in the world. Because we don't really know that much about Apollo, really, even though he's been in so many films and he's got this great legacy. We don't really know how he came to prominence. So I think that's a story to be told.
I love that. I think that's so good. I would totally watch that.
My idea. Copywriting.
There you go. There you go. Screenwriters, please queue at this door. What about you, Jack?
Most characters, I like the mystery of their background, but I think, you know, someone who there's actual source material for a background story, be Gandalf the Grey. I know they're doing a Lord of the Rings TV show, but I'd love to go into someone like his story beforehand. And obviously Tolkien wrote so much background for all his characters. So there's such a, you know, a rich source to adapt as well. So it almost, you know, would make complete sense, and I'd love to see it.
So we're going to have a young, sexy Jabba and a young, sexy Gandalf. I want to know what happened to the child catcher in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang to make him so hate children and be so good at sniffing them out. Did he always have a long nose? Does he dye that hair that lank black colour? Why is he such a horrible person? So yeah, I'd
like
to
see a scene of him getting his nose stretched out.
I want to know, why did he decide that all black was a thing for him? Why is his top hat bashed? Get it sorted. I want to know all of this. Does he have a wife? Is there a Mrs. Childcatcher? I'd like to know.
They're doing a Cruella de Vil one, aren't they? Is that so we're going to find out what made her?
Yes, with Emma Stone. Why not go through all of the sort of childhood baddies and find out what floats their boat?
And they're doing the Hunger Games prequel as well, aren't they?
They've, with President Snow. So it's a thing. Those are good ones. And if any film studios would like to come to us, we're open, right? Okay, shall we move on? Let's have a look at the new releases for this week. Let's get in the studio with this one.
I grew up around music. It's my whole world. If you told 12-year-old me that one day I'd be working for Grace Davis, she's an icon.
This woman doesn't even know your last name.
She does, sometimes.
Stop. I'm not gonna tell you guys you're great if you're not great. Do it again.
Damn, the girls still give me goosebumps.
Well, Grace, have you thought any more about the Vegas residency?
Actually, I think it's time I record a new album.
I mean, that's one plan.
So this is The High Note, starring Dakota Johnson as Maggie, the assistant to a megastar singer, Grace, who's played by Tracy Ellis Ross. Maggie dabbles in producing music and wants more for her boss than a Las Vegas residency. So what will happen when Grace reaches a crossroads in her career and Maggie wants to make it in music? Before we talk about the film, let's hear what Dakota Johnson and Tracy Ellis Ross had to say when our Hollywood correspondent, Adam Tanswell, chatted with them last week. First, he asked Dakota why she wanted to do this film.
When I read the script, I was really pleasantly surprised. Flora Griesen, who is the writer, is just infinitely talented and really smart and really funny. And I was really excited to be a part of this movie.
And what prep did she do to play a music producer?
For this role, I learned to play the piano. I learned to play the songs that are in the movie on the piano. I spent a bit of time with my friend Annie Clark, who is a musician. She goes by St. Vincent, and I stole a lot of things from her that she does in the studio. It was a few months of piano, and then also, you know, before work, early morning piano lessons, like very early morning, too early. But yeah, it was a couple months of prep.
And how did she find working with Tracy?
I mean, we met when we were in prep and we were rehearsing, and she's just so lovely to work with, and she's super talented and really smart and sweet, and it was a total joy. We rehearsed quite a bit, and I think everybody approaches work a different way, but we really just worked well with each other, and, you know, we were kind of game for anything.
And as the film explores fame and its repercussions, Adam asked how Dakota found fame to deal with herself.
You know, I really value my privacy and my personal life. I don't flaunt it, nor do I want that to be public, but there's an aspect of my job that is a part of it. So I respect it and I'm grateful for, you know, the success of my career so far. And it's a complicated thing. And, you know, I'm both lucky and also find it difficult.
When he sat down with Tracy, he asked her what the most challenging aspect of the film was.
There were two challenging parts of it. The acting just felt exciting and exhilarating to be able to kind of move into all different places of what it is to be a human being. The singing was a leap of faith for me. It was something I've never done before. So figuring that out and gaining my footing and being in the studio and learning how I'm comfortable in the studio, et cetera, was a learning process. And it had to happen very quickly. And also, you know, I'm very comfortable on stage. I enjoy being in front of people. I don't have any problem with that. But usually my experience with being on stage is hosting. And so there's a different energy to that. It's a little bit about comedy and sort of shtick and those kinds of things. But Grace Davis doesn't use comedy. Grace Davis is very in her power when she's on stage. And that took some work for me to find that kind of confidence and that kind of ease. I feel like Grace Davis is almost more at home on stage than she is in her house. And so I needed to find that. And so those were the two areas that required work on my part.
And did she get any prep advice from her mum, Diana Ross?
I did not get any advice from my mom, no. I worked with a vocal coach that helped me sort of move through my fear and make sure that my instrument was open. I worked with a wonderful producer. Our producer for the soundtrack was Rodney Jerkins, and he was just so pivotal to the process for me. I trusted him and he walked me through some, you know, learning something new with patience and with a lot of compassion. And it was really a quick process, but I jumped in really fast. And it was about choosing songs and getting comfortable standing in that vocal booth. I mean, it was really fun with the earphones on and the microphone in front of my face. I felt like I was a real recording star.
And seeing as Dakota and she both have famous families, did that create a different rapport for them?
We were just two actresses meeting who had a lot in common. And I don't think what we come from and who we come from had anything to do with what we brought to these roles. I know that Dakota has a great love of music. And so it really informed her in how she played this Maggie and wanted to be a producer. And for me, I have a love of music in a different way and my desire to be a singer. So I don't think where we come from and who our parents and grandparents are had much to do with this part at all.
All right. So the high note. You haven't seen it, Jack. We'll see if you want to after this. Matthew, what did you make of it?
Not very much.
Oh, dear.
High note is a bit of a misnomer. I thought Tracy Ellis Ross was the high note in the high note.
Mm-hmm.
However, I don't feel like they gave her enough space to really develop her character. I felt like they focused on the wrong character. It was all about Dakota Johnson's dreams of becoming a producer at the expense of exploring this, this pop superstar who's trying to make a comeback. And just there's so many cliches in it. It wants to be The Devil Wears Prada, but it just doesn't have that kind of bite to it. It kind of reminded me a bit of some of Cameron Crowe's films, like Almost Famous. Like there's loads and loads of trivia being dropped all the time, but it just didn't really have that authentic feel. Apart from, I thought, Tracy Ellis Ross. I mean, I guess she's drawing on her mother being Diana Ross, but at the same time, I felt she was very believable as this character, but she just feels sidelined throughout the film, really.
You know, you talk about authenticity. There are real life, you know, pop stars in this. I mean, he wouldn't call himself a pop star, but Ice Cube is playing her manager and Diplo playing this obnoxious producer. So they're sort of trying, and you know, they're always in these key LA night spots and like Capitol Records famous buildings. So all of this stuff that you really associate with music and that sort of legacy. I know it's a great film, but The Bodyguard, the way that that felt really weirdly not any sort of real music world. This feels very dislocated as well. Yeah. And for me, I thought it was really a disappointment that we had this quite interesting story, like you said, of a pop star who is sort of trying to negotiate her career in middle age and the fact that, you know, women in middle age in pop aren't really a going commodity, with this young woman who has ambitions, and their relationship is actually quite interesting. But then they throw in this random romance with this guy that sort of is stealing focus from this relationship that these two women are having. And actually, it would have been good just to see how they communicated with each other and how they drove each other to sort of pursue their dreams, and the way that they were coming at it from different angles actually helped each other out. And then combined with that, this weird comedic tone that wasn't actually funny, but made things feel much lighter and frothier than they were. So it sort of fell between two stools for me.
Terrible twist at the end.
There is a terrible twist.
Worthy, shameless twist that ties it all together in the really desperate fashion.
You haven't sold it to me. No. So far. It also sounds slightly ironic that, you know, a film that's trying to make a point about how women over 40 don't get hits and then decides to focus on the younger character. Yeah. Sounds a bit weird.
She has this great line where she says, but only five women over 40 have ever had a number one hit, and only one of them was black. So it raises all these kind of issues about gender and race and age, and then it does nothing with them. It just kind of shies away from all that and goes back to focusing on Dakota.
Felt like a really great wardrobe, and she does have a lovely trip to Catalina Island. It made me think I'd like to go to Catalina Island, where everyone drives golf carts around. But that's about it in terms of inspiration. It wasn't doing what it was trying to achieve, I don't think.
No.
And this was supposed to be on the big screen. I don't know that it would have found an audience there, do you?
No, I don't think so. No, it's far better suited to being watched out the corner of your eye, I think, on a laptop or a tablet, to be honest.
Yeah.
I would have felt even more let down if I'd seen this on the big screen, aside from the locations.
It's not great. But as we discussed last week with Lovebirds, if you are not paying a cinema price for this, it feels very much like something you could watch whilst you're having a glass of wine, and it's perfectly okay.
Yeah, it won't stress you out or anything. It's not.
It's not offensive.
Not hard to keep up with.
Yeah, it's not offensive, but it isn't doing anything new either.
The trailer looked really properly cheesy. I thought it'd be a real guilty pleasure, but it wasn't.
Were you hoping for Crossroads?
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's what you need.
Crossroads or Showgirls. Yeah. That's what we look for, really. Exactly. And also, as an assistant, she wasn't very good, was she?
No, she really wasn't.
And she sort of is really rude to this producer that's been chosen for her boss to produce her album in front of him. And that's supposed to be girl power. But actually, you just think, why would you do that? It's really disrespectful. But hey ho, maybe that's just me. okay, so we are recommending this if you fancy something to watch whilst you're eating your takeaway curry.
Yeah, if there's nothing else, if you exhausted all other options. Yeah, if you're really into music, really, really into music. If you really like one of the actors.
Yeah. Or do you enjoy a fringed leather jacket? Because Dakota has a lovely one of those. So that's The High Note, which is available on demand from Friday, the 29th of May. All right, so let's go to Netflix and take a look at their new show, which is this.
The president is creating a new branch
in the United States military.
Space Force, which Mark will run.
I don't.
It has always been my dream to start something from the ground up. But space is hard.
May I suggest that become the new Space Force motto?
So that's Space Force. Jack, set it up for us.
So Space Force is a comedy with Steve Carell where he plays Colonel Nard, who's in charge of the newly formed Space Force for the United States. And he's in charge of doing rocket launches and all sorts. And he's got a scientist advisor played by John Malkovich, who's kind of a spoof of Dr. Strangelove. And, you know, every episode's like a different mission or something that they have to do or something they have to solve. So in the first episode, there's a rocket launch that's going on and they have to make sure it goes off without a hitch, even though the scientists are telling them that it's not going to work.
Because it's the wrong weather, it's the wrong temperature.
Yeah, and Lieutenant Nard's, you know, he's not into listening to scientists. He needs to get the job done for POTUS. Yeah,
right. So, I mean, this is billed as from the creators of The Office. Carell has co-created it. It has a great cast. I mean, the comedy sort of stylings of all sorts of famous actors are in this. Malkovich, really like pulling a Malkovich. It has everything going for it, but does it work?
It's a weird one because there are moments where I really liked it. I've watched 5 episodes and the last one, the 5th one, was by far my favorite. But kind of building up to that, you know, it's like a all-star group of sitcom actors. You know, you've got Lisa Kudrow from Friends, Ben Schwartz from Parks and Rec, Steve Carell, it's from Greg Daniels. It's got everything that should work, but somehow it just like feels a bit disjointed. They make jokes about like Brexit and things like that.
Yeah.
And it feels a bit on the nose and a bit cringe. What did you think?
I liked it a lot. I know what you mean. You've got this kind of domestic comedy stuff going on and this kind of banal workplace politics. And then at the same time, they're sending up the current administration. I think after a while, it does start to knit together and you start to develop a more of a fondness for the characters. I mean, they do seem a bit kind of blunt and on the nose and unlikable at first. But as the series goes on, I think you kind of come to understand them a bit more. They get a bit more sympathetic. And some of the more minor ones, they become a bit more prominent. And kind of bonds and relationships start to grow. So, which I found was kind of similar with the US office as well. I found that at first, that was a bit kind of off-putting and distancing, but then it kind of developed this warmth. So I found that with this. And I just thought it was very funny as well. I thought there's some great episodes. There's a great one involving a monkey, which sort of feels almost plausible as well. I mean, it kind of feels ridiculous on the one hand, but on the other hand, something perhaps that could be put into practice somewhere, or someone's floated the idea, so. I liked it a lot.
You could kind of believe that this is actually happening. I mean, it's not in the thick of it. It's not sort of that level of sharp sort of critique of the government. But, you know, it is based on a real space force that is being put together. So some of these things I thought you could well believe might actually be happening somewhere in a carved out mountain in Colorado. But equally, I, you know, like Steve Carell is... just, I love him. And I think he can make anything funny. So quite a lot of this sort of for me is on his shoulders and he does a lot of heavy lifting. His line read of seemingly unfunny lines is just so good. And if you enjoy what he does in The Office and what he does in loads of films, then I think this is just sort of 10 episodes of total Carell treat, isn't it?
Yeah. I love the relationship between him and Malkovich as well. I think that starts to grow across the episodes. And he seems to be having a really good time, Malkovich. He seems really relaxed and having lots of fun. We don't often get to see him in something this kind of broad and silly, but he feels like he's really embraced it. I just loved his character.
Yeah. And then there's like the sort of sitcom-y elements of it as well. Sort of like the guy who is his secretary constantly lets people into his office and doesn't tell him. And it's like this running joke. And those sort of things to feel like, I haven't seen all 10, but if you sat with it by the end, you'd feel a real fondness for it, I think.
Yeah. And it's got Fred Willard, who's recently passed away, playing Carell's dad. So this is kind of his last role, and he's terrific as well. He has, you know, it's quite a small role, but he kind of pops in and out. It's nice to see him.
Yeah, whilst his son's using like the government satellite imaging to find his mother because she's wandered off to a Walgreens car park. You interviewed some of the cast, didn't you, Jack?
I did.
What did they have to say about this?
Not a whole lot. I mean, a lot of them found out about Space Force, the show, first before finding out about the real thing, because the two were working in tandem. So they would kind of read the script and then they would read about the actual Space Force in the news afterwards. So when the show was kind of coming up with their suits, then suddenly the real Space Force suits and the logo and stuff were being revealed. So that was quite entertaining. It was also weird because I spoke to John Malkovich and Ben Schwartz from my bedroom on Zoom, and they started chuckling about my bed because you can see my bed in the background, which was...
Had you not made it?
I have made it. It was quite funny. They just had a blank wall and John Malkovich had some paintings, and John Malkovich was very John Malkovich.
Okay, so I think we're probably recommending this as good fun escapism, which is what we all need now.
If you're not sold on the first one or two episodes, it's worth persevering and trying to get through, because I think it does get a lot better.
Yeah.
So that's Space Force, which starts on Netflix this Friday, the 29th of May. Okay, from one branch of the US military to another.
Operation Abilene was one of the bloodiest battles of the Vietnam War.
Everybody down!
An entire company nearly wiped out.
We are taking fire!
Prayed for a miracle. One came. His name is Pitts.
Pitts saved lives.
We put him up for the Medal of Honor.
but he never got the medal.
Justice delayed is justice denied.
So that's The Last Full Measure. Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
What is it about?
Well, this is a true story drama based on the story of Vietnam war hero William H. Pitzenberger, who's played in flashbacks by Jeremy Irvine, a medic who saved countless lives in Vietnam, but he didn't receive the Medal of Honor. And so in the present day, we have a member of the Pentagon, played by Sebastian Stan, who embarks on an investigation to find out why he didn't receive the Medal of Honor and perhaps restore it to him.
So this is very starry, this cast, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
It feels very glossy and classy. Just reel off some of the people that are in this.
Well, you've got Samuel Jackson, William Hurt, Christopher Plummer, Diane Ladd, Ed Harris, Peter Fonda in his last role, I believe.
Yes, there's just loads of classy people in this. But is it a classy film? Jack, what did you make of it?
It was very patriotic, and it was a very respectful film of the past of the Vietnam vets. But was it particularly entertaining? I'm not sure, like, it would reverberate the same with me, you know, a Brit as an American. You know exactly where the movie's going from the moment it starts. You know, you've got Sebastian Stan as this guy who isn't very respectful of the past and doesn't care. And you immediately know where that's going. Like
that he's going to end up blubbing at some point about it.
Yeah. It was enjoyable enough, I guess. It passed the time. You know, these almost cameos from all these famous people was quite distracting, really, because it was just like, oh, Ed Harris is in this film? Samuel Jackson's in this film? They all have like their scene.
Yeah, I found it really hard going for a while because it just seemed to be one gruff monologue after another by a distinguished old actor. So it got very, very repetitive. Towards the end, I did start to engage with it quite a lot more. I think the last half hour, I did find it quite moving. I have to admit, I did have a little sniffle at the end. Maybe just because of the quality of the acting, I think that kind of elevated it. When you've got all these very distinguished actors, that really redeemed it for me. But for the most part.
The script is quite cheesy, isn't it? And it's only the fact that these really great actors are delivering some of those lines that it doesn't become like a pastiche. You know, I opened my kit bag and all the clothes smelled of war. You know, only a decent actor can deliver that sort of weird telemovie. It really felt like a sort of TV movie, you know. Yeah. It felt very sort of like it was lecturing us on, you know, why people who aren't in the military should understand the military. And a lot of the characters were very aggressive towards Sebastian Stan's character. Like, you don't know what it's like. You have never met someone who's got PTSD. And so I found that quite interesting. And as much as, is there more of an interesting story there? You know, it felt like there was elements of Born on the 4th of July, this sort of the fact that as a society, Vietnam vets were not given mental and physical care when they returned that they should have had. So I found myself wanting a different film all the way through it rather than the one I was watching.
Yeah. It very much felt like it was a load of old people kind of going, kids, respect your elders. You're right, it did feel lecturing. And I think it, to a point where I just kind of switched off from it for a lot of it, because it just felt like getting pounded over the head with the same message every time one of these people showed up. You know, when someone kind of turns a gun on Sebastian Stan and it's just like, you don't understand. And it's like, oh, okay. And then Samuel Jackson comes on, you don't understand. It's like, I understand now. I don't need to be told like five times. And also the flashbacks to the war stuff when it was out in, that didn't quite work for me.
I found them a bit jarring, really. They didn't really feel like they had the production value. I mean, you can't help but compare those sort of scenes, things like Platoon and Apocalypse Now and Saving Private Ryan, anything like that. And they did feel maybe a little bit low rent in comparison. I felt they needed to have a lot more impact, really, those scenes.
The only thing that I sort of found musing, not that one should in a film like this, was the fact that Sebastian Stan's experience in trying to interview Samuel L. Jackson is very similar to a real experience of interviewing Samuel L. Jackson. Doesn't want to do it, wants to throw your tape recorder in a river, and is quite scary. So if you want to know what it's like to be in a room with Nick Fury, then this is a film that might give you some insight into that. And, you know, if you get a kick out of seeing Nick Fury and Winter Soldier fishing together, great, but it does feel like it's designed for people who perhaps already feel the way the protagonists feel and want that reinforcing in a sort of very serious and portentous way with sweeping orchestral music. I don't know that it does teach a new generation very much at all.
It feels kind of like one of those American Christian movies where, you know, they know the message and it's just about reaffirming what people know, and would no doubt, you know, playing to the right crowd in America will be completely fine. But I think to everyone else, it's just a bit like, you don't really want to watch this film. They say actors do like one for me, one for them, and this one feels like one for the paycheck. So yeah.
It's got the kind of cliched wife character as well, who's on the sidelines for most of the film and then
pregnant and serving coffee. Yeah.
But then gives the pep talk that kind of urges the hero on at the crucial moment, just when the chips are really down, then she kind of emerges into the spotlight for one brief moment. And I feel like I've seen that a number of times.
Yeah. And then when he gets his moment, she nods from the side like, yeah.
And also,
she's gone off and had this baby, like, without him being remotely involved. And she's just like jogging the baby, like, well done, son, for doing this. You know, like, what were you doing? You were fannying around Vietnam whilst she was about to have a baby, but hey ho. And he's a really ugly crier as well, Sebastian Stan. That was my takeaway. He cries.
For some reason, it didn't clock with me that it was Sebastian Stan for quite a long time. Like, he's very shaved and baby face.
Is that why?
Yeah, that was it.
He wasn't hitting Chris Evans.
Would you have been more into it had he had a metal arm?
I think it would have added something to his character that wasn't there, you know?
Because his character is extremely bland, and we don't get any sense, really. I didn't, even though he sort of tries to explain via the script why he keeps changing his mind and whether he's going to pursue this matter. You don't really get any sense of his motivation, do you?
No, not really. No, there's not much psychology going on. In a weird way, it's like the opposite of Dark Waters. You know, he's kind of one man against the system, but I mean, that did it so much better and with so much psychological insight and grit and shades of grey, where this doesn't have any of those, really. But I did find it moving, I will say.
If you're feeling predisposed to having a bit of a weep about valour and duty, or as everyone keeps saying in this, duty, then this is a film that you'll probably enjoy. But if you're hoping to learn anything about Vietnam or that particular incident, probably it's not going to inform you.
Yeah.
So we will recommend that if you're into that sort of thing. So that's The Last Full Measure, which is available on all digital platforms from Monday, the 1st of June. So it's time now, boys, to test your movie space knowledge. Are you ready for your quiz?
Getting ready to launch.
Getting ready to launch. Here we go. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks he'd blow our minds. There's a starman waiting. This is 2020, a quiz odyssey. Ah. All right, shall we start with Jack? So, Jack, what is the name of Peter Quill's mother? Is it Melanie, Martha, or Meredith?
Martha's Batman's mum and Superman's mum.
Yes. How could we forget?
Yeah, exactly. So, I think it's Meredith, if I remember correctly.
Correct, it is. Well done. 1 point to you. No. Okay, Matthew, the hero spaceship in Galaxy Quest is called Protector, Defender, or Gatekeeper?
Years since I've seen that. I don't think it's Gatekeeper. Is it Defender?
It's Protector. Oh. Jack's in the lead. All right, Jack, here's yours. In which year was John Carpenter's Dark Star made? Was it 1974, 1975, or 1976?
I haven't seen this film. I don't know when it was made, so I'm going to go with C, 1970 something.
Well, it was 1977. It was 1974, which was answer A, so no points for you. Okay, Matthew. In Spaceballs, who provides the voice of the C-3PO-alike robot Dot Matrix? Is it Roseanne Barr, Joan Rivers, or Sybil Shepherd?
I know this. It's Joan Rivers.
Correct. 1 point each. Okay. Which actor made their feature debut in the 1991 Critters 3? Bradley Cooper, Leonardo DiCaprio, or David Harbour? Jack, which is it?
I believe that's Leonardo DiCaprio.
Correct. Well done.
Well done.
Okay, awesome. Matthew, in their 1953 space adventure, did Abbott and Costello go to the moon, to Mars, or to Planet Funny?
Well, surely they always went to Planet Funny.
Yeah.
I'm going to say the moon. They went to the moon.
It was Mars. No points. Jack's in the lead. Okay, here we go. This is Jack again. Talk About the Wrong Stuff is a zinger from which blockbuster? Independence Day, Men in Black 2, or Armageddon? I recently watched this film again, and it's full of quality like this.
Is it Armageddon?
It is Armageddon. Okay, so Jack's 3 points to Matthew's one. So Matthew, who directed 2005's The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Garth Jennings, Peter Howitt, or PJ Hogan?
It's Garth Jennings, I know that. I remember going to the press conference for that.
Brilliant, you are correct. Yeah. One more point, so it's 3-2. Okay, Jack, ready? Which character said the very first, I have a bad feeling about this? Was it Leia, Han, or Luke?
It's either, I feel like Han. Han? Is it Han? Han's the one who famously says it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with Han. B.
It's Luke.
So. Oh, I could feel Matthew's disgust at me for getting that wrong as well.
Absolutely. Okay, so Matthew, Australian comedy The Dish centred on which historical event? The Apollo 13 mission, the Apollo 11 mission, or the launch of Sputnik?
That's another one. It's a long decade since I've seen that. I think Sputnik. Sputnik.
It's Apollo 11. No points for you. Okay. Jack, which actor-singer has an uncredited vocal cameo in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2? Is it John Legend, Taylor Swift, or Miley Cyrus?
I believe that one's Miley Cyrus.
Correct. 4 points. Here we go, Matthew. Yep. 2001, A Space Odyssey is a classic written by Stanley Kubrick and which other sci-fi giant? John Scalzi, Isaac Asimov, Philip K. Dick, or Arthur C. Clarke?
It's Arthur C. Clarke.
Correct. Okay, so still Jack won that. 4-3.
Hello.
4-3, though.
So, not bad. Well done, boys.
Well done,
okay,
Jack.
Well done. So, let's just remember that there's a new issue on sale tomorrow, Friday the 29th of May, which has Tenet on the front cover. And as always, there's 10% off total film subscriptions with the code INSIDETF when you go to checkout at www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk. Okay, so that's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more quiz and more reviews of films that are probably mediocre, because that seems to be the thing. Come on, Christopher Nolan, get Tenet in the cinemas. That's what we need. Okay, so say goodbye, boys, and we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye for me.